From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, more warnings to Russia regarding Ukraine. Pistorius breaks down during testimony at his murder trial. Human rights groups condemning a Cairo court verdict. Plus, a new amnesty manual aims at fair trials. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukraine's government struggled Tuesday to assert and maintain control of key cities in its pro-Russian east as pressure is mounting to bridge ethnic and political divides that threaten to further split the country. Meantime, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Tuesday that Russia is fueling separatist unrest in eastern Ukraine that could be a contrived crisis to justify military intervention. The story from VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns.
Secretary of State John Kerry says President Barack Obama is preparing a far tougher series of sanctions if Russia does not step back from what he calls its clear and unmistakable involvement in destabilizing eastern Ukraine.
So Russia has a choice: to work with the international community to help build an independent Ukraine that could be a bridge between East and West, not the object of a tug of war, that could meet the hopes and aspirations of all Ukrainians, or they could face greater isolation and pay the cost for their failure to see that the world is not a zero-sum game.
Pro-Russian separatists in southeastern regions are demanding referenda on a split with Ukraine, the same kind of vote that took place last month in Crimea after Russian troops took control there. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says those regions should be included in talks next week with the United States, European Union, and Ukrainian government. Secretary Kerry told U.S. lawmakers it's not a small matter that Russia has agreed to those talks. But before then, he says Moscow must disavow separatist actions, pull back troops along the border, and demonstrate that they'll do what's necessary to de-escalate. Republican Senator Bob Corker says the Obama administration is inconsistent by criticizing Russian action while agreeing to include them in talks on Ukraine's future.
We castigate them on one side. On the other hand, we're exchanging paper with them. I'm confused about what our policy really is.
Kerry says Washington's preference is a negotiated settlement, but it will not hesitate to use what he calls 21st century tools to hold Russia accountable for 19th century behavior.
These efforts are as ham-handed as they are transparent, frankly. And quite simply, what we see from Russia is an illegal and illegitimate effort to destabilize a sovereign state and create a contrived crisis with paid operatives across an international boundary.
Russia's foreign ministry is calling for provisional authorities in Kiev to halt what it called military preparations in southeast regions that could lead to civil war. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula has placed the spotlight on NATO. Secretary Kerry just mentioned last week's meeting in Brussels, where the alliance made some decisions about its relationship with Russia in light of the annexation. VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshna taking a look now at NATO's response to the current crisis over Crimea and eastern Ukraine.
Experts say Russia's military incursion into Ukraine and its annexation of Crimea was a wake-up call for the 28-member NATO alliance. Charles Kupchin, NATO expert at Georgetown University, says since the end of the Cold War, the Western alliance has been trying to redefine its mission.
A few months ago, people were talking about an existential crisis for the alliance in the absence of the mission in Afghanistan. The bulk of NATO troops are scheduled to be out by the end of 2014. And the question was, okay, what next? And now I think there is a revival of NATO's traditional mission of collective defense.
That policy stipulates that an attack on one member is an attack on all of them. During a recent NATO meeting, Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen reaffirmed the alliance's commitment to collective defense, saying, "We will deter and defend against any threat."
We have already reinforced NATO's presence on the eastern borders of the alliance. We are flying AWACS surveillance patrols over Poland and Romania. We have more than doubled the number of fighter aircraft allocated to the NATO air policing mission in the Baltic states.
Poland and Romania are NATO members that border Ukraine on the west. Russia has amassed thousands of troops on its border with Ukraine, prompting Western experts to say an incursion into eastern Ukraine is likely. Charles Kupchin says NATO would react even more to protect its members.
You would see a considerable expansion in the moves that NATO has already taken to beef up defenses on its eastern frontier, perhaps even including reneging on the gentleman's agreement that was struck when Central European members entered NATO, which was to say to the Russians, we will not forward deploy substantial numbers of NATO troops in Central Europe.
Kupchin says NATO's reaction will be short of war.
The prospect of a clash between NATO forces and Russia over Ukraine is effectively out of the question. And that's because there has been an assessment on this side of the Atlantic as well as in Europe that what has happened and what could potentially happen in Eastern Europe, in Eastern Ukraine, is not the stuff of war. That is to say, war between the Western democracies and Russia.
Sean Kay, NATO expert at Ohio Wesleyan University, agrees. But he says Russian forces will have a difficult time if they enter eastern Ukraine.
There's not a lot we can do to stop them, but their military capabilities are actually still pretty thin. They can do a thing like the Georgia War, but that was a pretty small conflict with highly trained and integrated forces. But to sustain a large deployment of forces over a very long period of time in a hostile territory, that's going to be difficult for the Russians to do.
Charles Kupchin puts it this way.
For Putin to head into eastern Ukraine, he opens a Pandora's box. He risks a civil war on his border. He risks miring Russian troops in something that could look like another Afghanistan.
As a result of Russia's military intervention in Crimea, NATO has suspended all civilian and military cooperation with Moscow. NATO officials say they will review their relationship with Moscow in view of Russia's actions. Andre Dineshner, VOA News, Washington.
Ukraine's Petro Poroshenko, a self-made confectionery business icon worth an estimated $1.3 billion, has emerged as the front-runner in opinion polls leading up to Ukraine's presidential election scheduled for May. The survey shows the one-time foreign minister well ahead of his main rival, former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. Henry Ridgewell profiling now the man who has pledged to rescue Ukraine's economy and face down Russia.
Petro Poroshenko is known as the Chocolate King in Ukraine, having built a fortune on confectionery, but he is no stranger to politics. He was a regular speaker at Kiev's Independence Square at the height of the recent protests, denouncing corruption and calling for membership of the European Union. Arisia Lutsevich is at the London-based policy institute Chatham House.
He became so popular during the recent protest because he was giving some kind of confidence in terms of his direct action and also because he was not affiliated with the existing political parties.
Poroshenko has received the backing of opposition leader and former boxer Vitali Klitschko. In a recent interview, Poroshenko said he would build on Ukraine's revolution.
It was born the new country. It was born the new people. But unfortunately, it left old politician. And I try to do my best that the politician, the government, the authorities, and the president be adequate to the new people from the revolution.
Poroshenko played a big role in the Orange Revolution in 2004 alongside his now rival Yulia Tymoshenko, becoming foreign minister under the then president Viktor Yushchenko. He built his fortune on the back of his giant chocolate company Roshen alongside media and manufacturing interests. Observers say he is cultivating an image as a safe pair of hands.
You can come here in a very safe, in a very nice country, yeah, with a very experienced labor, with a very effective cheap cost for the creation of the businesses, and the only obstacle for doing that is the corruption. That's why is it a top priority during the modernization.
His status as a self-made billionaire sets him apart from Ukraine's other business elites, who are often seen as corrupt, says Arisia Lutsevich of Chatham House.
He has good understanding of the way international financial markets are working, and he is on good term basis with a lot of Western politicians. But also, you know, he is somebody who understands Russia because he's doing a lot of his business with the confectionery and sugar industries are in Russia.
But Poroshenko's relations with the Kremlin are poor, says Russia specialist Andrew Foxall of analyst group the Henry Jackson Society.
His Russian confectionery business was subject to trade sanctions and embargoes by the Russian government. The business lost an awful lot of money. He lost an awful lot of money. More recently, Poroshenko's assets in Russia have been targeted.
Petro Poroshenko has said he will never accept Russia's forceful annexation of Crimea. Russia has deployed tens of thousands of troops along the Ukrainian border. Whoever wins the May 25th election, victory will mark just the beginning of the daunting challenges that face Ukraine's next leader. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
The World Food Program is warning a looming drought in conflict-ridden Syria could put millions of lives at risk. Lisa Schlein reports.
Syria suffered a severe drought in 2008, which persisted into 2010. Vulnerable communities in affected areas of the country barely had a chance to recover from food shortages and rising prices arising from this event before it was plunged into war in 2011. The World Food Program warns the potential impact of a looming drought hitting the northwest of Syria could seriously affect the next cereal harvest. It says 6.5 million people could be at risk of acute food shortages and they will need international aid to survive. WFP spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers tells VOA, rainfall since September has been less than half the long-term average.
There is only 1 month left in the rainfall season that lasts until mid-May, and with three quarters of the rainfall season gone, it is unlikely there will be a significant recovery in this agricultural season. I'm just saying that this situation is of concern because it will add another problem on top of the conflict consequence impact for the people who already need urgent life-saving assistance.
The WFP Special Focus Syria report finds dry conditions affecting the wider Middle East will compound the impact of the civil war on the agricultural sector. The report says the northwest of the country, in particular the Aleppo, Idlib, and Hama governorates, are the worst affected. These areas account for nearly half of Syrian wheat production. The report notes livestock also will suffer from water shortages and the lack of grazing land. A UN Refugee Agency spokeswoman, Fatoumata Lejeune-Kaba, says a major drought could lead to more displacement.
We can expect more refugees to leave if, on top of the conflict, they feel that their lives are in danger because there is no food. But it's hard to say, obviously, how many, because they could also move to other parts of Syria.
The World Food Program says it hopes to reach 4.2 million displaced people in Syria with food assistance in April. But it notes it is short of cash, so beneficiaries this month will have their food rations cut by 16%. The agency says it requires about $41 million every week to meet the food needs of people affected by the conflict in Syria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
World Health Organization says the ongoing Ebola outbreak in West Africa is one of the most challenging it's ever faced. The outbreak has resulted in more than 110 deaths. Guinea remains the center with nearly 160 suspected or confirmed cases of Ebola. Another 31 cases are suspected or confirmed in Liberia. 21 years after close to 1 million people were slaughtered in the Rwandan genocide, U.S. military officials are confident that forces are better positioned now to prevent a repeat of such mass slaughter. VOA's Jeff Seldon reporting from the Pentagon.
Fears run rampant across much of the Central African Republic, where 2,000 people have been killed in ethnic violence since December, and some African peacekeepers have already pulled out. But U.S. defense officials say that African forces have been able to intervene is a sign things are slowly improving.
The African forces that now are available that participate in these intervention and those type of things have expanded incredibly in the last 20 years. I mean, six nations in Somalia, nine going to 16 in Mali.
And the commander of the U.S. Africa Command, General David Rodriguez, says American forces are also better positioned to respond, with as many as 6,000 troops on the ground, including some at a forward operating base in Djibouti and trainers in Uganda, aiding the effort to track and stop warlord Joseph Kony and his Lord's Resistance Army.
They continue to get weaker every day, and we're going to continue to support the efforts of the African Union Regional Task Force to finish this off.
But deep concerns remain about the growing nexus of extremists, especially in northeastern Mali and southwestern Libya. Rodriguez points to the 2013 attack on a gas facility in En Amenas, Algeria, where three al-Qaeda-linked groups joined forces.
They're also transferring things that are very worrisome, like the IED technology and tactics, techniques, and procedures.
In addition, U.S. defense officials say they and their African partners worry about the flow of extremist fighters to Syria and their eventual return across sometimes porous borders. But even as U.S. forces draw down from Afghanistan, Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary for African Affairs Amanda Dory says don't expect a heavier U.S. presence in Africa.
Our small footprint and targeted support, working with willing partners, fulfills both our own strategic approach and is the way our African partners prefer to work with us.
However, U.S. officials do say they are considering ways to improve military capabilities, especially in West Africa. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, The Pentagon.
South African runner Oscar Pistorius broke down in sobs Tuesday as he described the moment he realized he had fatally shot his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, at his Pretoria home. And as VOA's Pam Dawkins reports, his emotional recount of last year's shooting took place during his second day of testimony at his murder trial.
I wasn't sure somebody was going to come out to the toilet to attack me.
Oscar Pistorius, testifying in court Tuesday, said he initially thought an intruder was inside his bathroom behind a locked door. As he approached, he heard noises inside.
What I perceived to be somebody coming out of the toilet. Before I knew it, I'd fired four shots at the door. My ears were ringing. I couldn't hear anything. So I shouted. I kept on shouting for Reva to phone the police.
The athlete described frantic moments after the shooting. He says he went back to the bedroom looking for Steenkamp. When he realized she was not there, he tried to kick open the bathroom door. He then pounded the door with a cricket bat.
Flung the door open, I threw it open, and I sat over Reva and I cried. And I don't know how long... I don't know how long I was there for. She wasn't breathing.
I think we're taking her, Jen. Got to religion.
After a brief break, the judge adjourned court for the day. The athlete, known as the Blade Runner for his prosthetic legs, says the shooting was accidental and on Monday apologized in court to Steenkamp's family. Prosecutors say he intentionally shot Steenkamp. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Washington.
Amnesty International has issued a new manual designed to promote fair trials around the world and said it should have an impact even in some of the world's most repressive countries. VOA's Al Pessin reporting from London.
The thick paperback manual has chapters on such topics as the right to liberty and the right to equality before the law. It includes sections on dealing with torture, children's rights, death penalty cases, and military courts, among others. The manual is aimed at lawyers and judges, but the previous edition, published 15 years ago, was also used by ordinary people to help them press for their own rights. Amnesty's head of international law and policy, Michael Bohenik, says fair trial problems are concentrated in repressive societies, but also exist in developed democracies. He says the problems are most prevalent in countries in crisis.
We continue to see backsliding year in and year out when it comes to things like how you respond to public protest, how you deal with political opponents, how you avoid reaching for easy solutions in an effort to solve what's actually a far more difficult social problem.
Bohenik says the manual is based on international and regional legal standards and so provides a tool to educate judges, lawyers, and political leaders and to put pressure on them when necessary.
I think there's a growing recognition of what it takes to adhere to due process, and I think there's more sensitivity than ever before and more opportunity for states to be held to account publicly than ever before.
He says no official wants to be singled out for using torture or for violating widely recognized rights, even in the most repressive societies.
It may be that in particular cases where we're seeing the most abuses, these kinds of standards we're pointing to are going to be disregarded. But it makes a difference over time in the way that more generally they respect the fair trial rights that everybody should have.
Bohenik says no single project like the Fair Trials Manual can end the many problems in legal systems around the world, but he says it's an important part of the effort to protect what he calls one of the basic building blocks of life in a democratic society. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com for 50 years helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Search crews in the Indian Ocean have reacquired the underwater signal they believe could belong to the black box of the missing Malaysian jetliner. Australian search chief Angus Houston said a U.S. Navy-towed pinger locator acquired the signal of two separate occasions on Tuesday. Houston told a news conference early Wednesday that's today the signal will help narrow the search area, but that it still stands at about 75,000 square kilometers. The retired Air Chief Marshal said authorities will not let or will not yet deploy a robot submarine to search the ocean floor. For now, he said it's important that the search for signals continue. It has now been more than a month since the Boeing 777, which was carrying 239 people, disappeared on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. The batteries on the plane's black box locator beacon were expected to last only about 30 days, meaning authorities are running out of time to locate those signals. International Monetary Fund says the global economic recovery is strengthening. Olivier Blanchard is IMF economic counselor.
Put simply, the recovery is strengthening. We forecast world growth to be 3.6% this year, 2014, 3.9% next year, up from 3.3% in 2013.
Blanchard said the recovery around the world is uneven. He said it's strongest in the U.S., where the IMF is projecting a 2.8% advance this year. Blanchard said Germany, the top economy in the 18-nation bloc that uses the euro currency, that is, will advance 1.7%. He said emerging and developing countries will continue to have strong growth, 4.9%, up slightly from 2013. And the IMF is saying that geopolitical risks have increased but not yet had a global economic impact. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. Reminder, you can always find us on the Internet at voanews.com. And the latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On April 9th, 1626, English philosopher and statesman Sir Francis Bacon died. When charges of corruption forced his retirement from government service, he turned to literary and scientific activities and is known as an advocate of inductive reasoning and the scientific method. On this date in 1682, the French explorer Robert La Salle claimed the lands around the mouth of the Mississippi River for France, renaming the territory Louisiana in honor of King Louis XIV. In 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee met with Union General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia to discuss terms of surrender. The surrender effectively ended America's Civil War, a conflict that resulted in over a million casualties. In 1867, the United States Senate agreed by a single vote to a treaty purchasing the territory of Alaska from Russia. In 1914, the first full-color movie was shown. The film shown in London was titled The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. In 1939, noted singer Marian Anderson performed to a crowd of 75,000 gathered at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Anderson had been denied entrance to the racially segregated Constitution Hall, but had been invited by the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, to sing at the memorial. In 1940, Nazi Germany invaded Norway and Denmark. In 1959, the U.S. space agency NASA introduced seven astronauts to the public. They would take part in America's first manned space program, Project Mercury. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late March, as part of the U.S. government's drive toward gender equality and global elimination of gender-based violence, or GBV, the Department of State, working through its Bureau for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, introduced the Gender-Based Violence Emergency Response and Protection Initiative. This program aims to provide immediate financial assistance for survivors of severe gender-based violence, as well as for those who find themselves under threat of imminent attack due to their gender or gender identity. This is a first-of-its-kind global program dedicated to aiding survivors of extreme forms of gender-based violence everywhere. The network will be funded by the State Department and run by a consortium of non-governmental organizations. Those organizations include Vital Voices Global Partnership, ProMundo U.S., the International Organization for Migration, and the American Bar Association Rule of Law Initiative. The new Gender-Based Violence Emergency and Protection Initiative builds on and complements past U.S. efforts to eliminate gender-based violence, said U.S. Deputy Secretary Robert Burns. It has three clear objectives. First, survivors of gender-based violence will help receive urgent support, like immediate medical help, emergency shelter, psychosocial support, and legal assistance. Second, the program will provide targeted training for governments and civil society on GBV-related laws and advocacy. These trainings support men and women working to put an end to gender-based violence. And finally, all partners in the initiative will work to develop a regional and international network of service providers and activists in 11 country hubs. From Mexico to Mali and Tajikistan to Thailand, these networks will share data, lessons learned, and best practices, coordinate emergency responses, and work together on shared advocacy efforts, said Deputy Secretary Burns.
Gender-based violence is an inexcusable crime and an affront to dignity and human rights. It robs people, disproportionately women and girls, of their potential and threatens their mental, physical, and reproductive health. It denies economic opportunity and undermines economic growth. And it imperils the safety and stability of communities and of countries.
To make a lasting impact, he said, we need to match the scope of this challenge with the intensity of our response. It will require each and every one of us to stay focused, to continue to marry words with deeds, and to never be content with cheering from the sidelines when we can join the global effort to end the epidemic of gender-based violence once and for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.